is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And good day, everybody, and thank you very much for taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And for those that are with us live, I always like to put forward the altar call. If you are so inclined, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where if you have some observations you'd like to make during the course of the show, or if there's a question you would like for us to direct to our guest over the course of the next hour, that's the perfect place to go. And we'll be monitoring during the course of the show, and we'll be glad to bring in your ideas as we go forward. And as always, if you need to step out halfway through the show and you want to catch up on what you missed, if you don't already, most people already do. Go ahead and subscribe to the podcast over on iTunes, Spotify, Spreaker, whichever aggregator you use, and that way we'll be ready for you at a time that better meets with your schedule. And let's go ahead and roll into the topic of the day. Today we're going to dive in. We're going to go back to the People's Republic of China, and we're going to look at it from, if not a different point of view, but a broader pixel point of view than some of the real focus shows we've been having as of recently. And we definitely have one guest. We might have two before the show is done once we get our IT working. But the baseline of our show today was co-authored by two of our guests, Jeffrey Miser from the University of Portland in Oregon, and Rennie Babars, if I'm mispronouncing that, my apologies, from the Johns Hopkins University Geospatial Intelligence Program over on the winter edition of the Naval War College Review. They co-authored, along with a third individual, Strategy, Uncertainty, and the China Challenge. And in the abstract, I just want to go ahead and state this here because I think it gives a good outline of what we'll be talking about for the next hour. Quote, despite China's increasing aggressiveness, its intentions are indeterminate, even aligning with U.S. interests in some areas. Furthermore, China simply may fail in achieving even its foremost national and foreign policy goals. Given this uncertainty, the United States should not base its foreign policy and strategy on any specific prediction about Chinese intentions or abilities. And with that note, Jeff, being that we got you on board, you might be going solo today, but I appreciate your flexibility, and welcome to Midrats.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Just to kick off as a kind of a scene setter, I thought I'd give you all the room to run into, to run around that you want to. But for the listeners, they can get the link over at the show page. If they haven't read it already, they can read it as we talk and go through it. But talk a bit about your article. What's the premise of the article, and what brought you to wanting to go ahead and get together with your co-authors and put it out there?
Yeah, thank you. So I think the beginning of the idea for the article was what seemed to be, and I'll put this out there, that this is Naval War College Review, is a quarterly publication, so the publication cycle is, it's a long-term thing. So we started writing this probably 2 years ago, and then over that time revised it and so on as we got close to publication. But so the idea was that it seemed like there was a growing consensus that China was intent on, or is intent on, dominating the world, that they will use military power to do so, that there's even an imminent military threat from China, you know, any day kind of thing. It seemed like there was a growing consensus that this was just the way it was, and there was no other real possibilities out there. So taking that point of view, we thought that that seemed a bit overconfident. And again, one big theme of the article is not that we're saying China is going to do this or going to do that. It's that we're saying we don't know. And that because of that uncertainty, that should shape U.S. foreign policy, U.S. strategy towards China. And so just the idea of let's take a step back and think about what the uncertainty is, mainly in two big categories. One is that, what does China really intend to do? And then you have to, of course, on that, dig into, you know, we're talking about really the Chinese leadership and what they intend to do, what they're able to do given the domestic constraints that are happening in China, and what they're able to do in terms of international constraints. What are their capabilities really to go out and do some of the things that it seems like at least some people think that they kind of want to do? So even if China is dead set on dominating the world, what are the chances that that could actually happen or not? And so trying to think in those terms and think about, well, if there is considerable uncertainty here, how should we then handle that? That's sort of the impetus for and sort of like the broad outline of where we're coming from in the article.
One of the things I liked about the approach you took in mentioning the overconfidence of the current view toward China was that you did touch upon the overconfidence in the past where we were the U.S. and other countries were pretty well sure that if we allowed China to develop and prosper, that they would magically join the free nations and the international world order that existed and that allows for freedom of the seas and commerce and all that. Somewhere along the line, and I think you addressed this, the Chinese leadership changed and their view of openness may have shifted a little bit. That overconfidence that we had for all those years seems to have affected how the U.S. approaches things. Is your article in some ways a response to that overconfidence and making sure we don't bend too far the other direction and portraying China as a sure opponent in all things?
Right. Yeah, that I think was an interesting moment. We kind of thought, we're trying to think about the path of our policies towards China. And then it was really interesting to go back and find some of those quotes from as far back as, you know, the 70s and 80s about how China was definitely going to – it was really funny. It was in the early 80s, even the late 70s, it was that, oh, yeah, China is liberalizing. It's really going this route. And – yeah, that really did affect us too about how people do get kind of locked in on a set of ideas and they become entrenched and you go with it. And it's really important to keep rethinking that. And, you know, at the time, especially if you go all the way back to like Nixon going to China, there was certainly value in doing engagement with China. And every decade since, there was always some value in having that engagement with China, but it became seemingly an unbalanced policy that people weren't really, you know, questioning anymore, and it became entrenched. And so we're kind of worried that we're going to shift from being way too far on the engagement side to way too far on the hostile threat kind of side. So, yeah, I think that's an important point.
And, again, one thing that I thought really not really unique, but we don't see enough of is – over the years we've done the podcast, we've had various guests on to talk about Russia and China. And one thing that Mark and I will bring up on a regular basis is, you know, be careful of projection because the Chinese and the Russians, it's not that they don't think differently than we do, but they have different cultural contexts in addition to having a different history than we are the people that we're usually used to working with, the French, the British, the Italians, the Germans are trying to be opponents against the Russians, who are their own little thing. That China has not only their own distinct and very long history, but also they have some philosophical underpinnings on how they see themselves and their world and how to react to it that isn't a significant part of the intellectual stew here. For instance, Confucianism and Taoism. Talk for a little bit about how, why y'all wanted to bring in these deeper philosophical and ethical underpinnings of how China views themselves and their relationship to other nations around them.
Yeah, this would be a great part for Rennie to jump in, but I can handle it to some degree with the knowledge that he's the real deep China expert and studied China for a long time. But the way so approached the article was influenced a lot by a book I published in 2015, I think, and it was about the rise of the United States. And the United States is a rising power, looking basically from the 1890s up to World War II. And so getting into some depth about how the U.S. did it and all the cultural and institutional factors that were going on in shaping and driving U.S. Grand strategy during that time period really shaped how I view other countries. And so when I try and think about, like Russia or China or any of these other countries, what they might do or not, I always think in terms of, well, what's the domestic cultural and institutional context in which they're working, and that's going to shape significantly what options are available, what policy options are even available for them to pursue. So, you know, going back looking at the U.S. during that time period, there was, you had people like McKinley, Taft, Roosevelt, who were on the expansionist side of the equation, and then you had a whole large set of very powerful anti-imperialists at that time. And so the way in the U.S. it works out is that there's the Senate, and the Senate can block treaties, especially back then when presidents actually submitted treaties that were treaties to the Senate, as they should. So there's very interesting cultural and institutional characteristics of the United States. So then, not saying that China is like the United States, but I think every country does have some kind of cultural and institutional context that really fundamentally shapes what leaders can do or not. Go back to the U.S. real quickly there, is that it seems that, you know, Theodore Roosevelt, in his, especially early in his administration, like, he really thought that imperialism was the way to go. He'd been advocating that for a while before being president. But he found, there's even quotes of him saying, like, gosh, I wish the United States was a country that could be imperialist, because I think we could be great imperialists, but the way our system is structured, we just can't do it. And this is him in response to trying to strengthen the U.S. position in the Philippines and so on. So I think looking at the China part of, you know, the China context, is that they certainly don't have, you know, a system of checks and balances like the United States. It's a vastly different system. But they certainly do have important cultural characteristics there that can combine in various different ways. So you have Confucianism, Taoism, you have more recent concepts from Mao, and even now I think Xi Jinping. I mean, one way to look at this is, why is Xi Jinping really trying to push this new ideological line, Xi Jinping thought and so on, is that he's plausibly trying to create new space for him to be able to act within, in terms of this cultural ideological milieu in China, and to kind of push China in a certain direction ideologically and culturally, you know. So I think that it's important. I don't think, you know, we use the term strategic culture in the paper. I also use it in my book. And some people seem to use that as being like, oh, strategic culture always points in one direction, and countries are a certain way in terms of their identity and culture, and they're definitely going to behave in this way. I think that's totally inaccurate, because every country has, you know, different subcultures within it that then push sometimes in different directions. So like in U.S. history, there's definitely been a very strong expansionist line. You know, the U.S. expanded across the whole continent. So expansionism is definitely part of U.S. culture and in history. But then when the U.S. shifted to, are we going to actually be a colonial power and govern people who don't want to be governed by us? That really came into conflict with anti-imperialism rooted in this, the American culture of classical liberalism and republicanism. And so there's always going to be sort of a tension within the culture. So this is something that Xi Jinping and the CCP have to deal with, is that is China a harmonious country, a harmonious and peaceful country that really just wants harmony for the world? That's sort of one element of Chinese culture. Or in terms of thinking about like the Chinese dream, is China need to go out and struggle and achieve and things like that. So there are always these elements that are, you know, pushing against each other. And so that to us is one element of the uncertainty. And you'll take someone like, you know, John Mearsheimer, he'll be like, oh no, China is this hardcore culture of offensive realists essentially, and they're going to go for it. that's just simply not true if you look at the history of Chinese, you know, cultural thought and ideology and so on. So really just wanted to bring to light, you know, we're not saying China is a pacifist, you know, Confucianist sort of country. We're saying there's that element there. And we're saying there's the other elements too that are more aggressive, but you have to kind of balance those, you know, when you think about what China may or may not do.
Yeah, I again, one of the things that, you know, if you study the history of China, they seem to be, for several thousand years, they've got a culture that far out, much older than the U.S. history, which was created. So, you know, they've got the weight of all that history. And one of the things they seem to always go back to is seeking stability, some kind of, as you say, harmony. And, you know, and I think one of the things you said in here was that they didn't really like the chaotic excesses of Western rights-based liberal democracy. And I thought, well, that's you know, that makes some sense. Chaos is bad. If you're Chinese, they worry about that. And one of the issues is, in seeking harmony, and this goes back kind of the Middle Kingdom when everybody was going to pay a tribute to the Chinese emperor and follow along the Chinese way. Is it? I mean, this is one of the many questions I guess you have to address. Is it one of the ways they seek to do this is by imposing probably not by force, but just being so big, so vast, and so demanding, the way they've taken over like the South China Sea, imposing this harmony on their neighbors and seeking to impose that same rule, which is kind of directly contrary to the current international order that the U.S. and our allies tend to support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. I think that, and that's one of the interesting and intriguing and really difficult things about kind of understanding this background of ideas and culture is, so, well, what does it mean to be harmonious, which I think is exactly the point, you know, you're getting at. And it can be defined in different ways. And I think, to some degree, China seems to be saying through some of its diplomacy and actions is that, well, it's harmonious as long as you do what we say. And that's not what a lot of other countries would view as being harmonious, or you know, in terms of thinking of harmonious as being, have some justice element there, like we wouldn't want to follow that, right? So I think that that's probably where China would like to be in terms of its position of saying, yes, it's going to be harmonious as long as you submit, you pay fealty to China, and then we're going to be cool with you, you're going to be cool with us, and everything will be fine. We're not going to impose our will on you necessarily, but we want you to accept that we are the big player here, and you have to be subservient to us to some degree, which there is a history of that, too, in terms of Chinese history, right? So I think that's probably one of the areas where, you know, China and the U.S. and other countries sort of talk past each other a bit in terms of China saying, well, we want harmony, and everybody saying, oh, yeah, okay, harmony, but China meaning something probably different by it than other countries, perhaps. And I think one maybe intriguing example here is the Philippines under Duterte, and it seemed like Duterte wanted to, you know, engage and have a friendship with China, friendly relationship, but that was kind of hard to do, and China kept, you know, infringing upon, you know, Philippine sovereignty over and over again. It didn't really work out. And so I think that the Chinese perspective was like, yeah, we'll be friends. You have to follow our line. You can't be friends in terms of being equals. You know, you have to know your place, essentially, which, of course, and then to a certain extent, if China is able to effectively pursue that line, that's probably the most dangerous sort of line in terms of U.S. interests, is that China, through its sort of force of gravity almost, just sort of pulls everybody in East Asia in as part of the Chinese sphere, and then the U.S. loses allies, and this is where we go down probably a pretty negative route.
In your article, you also outline, by their leaders, basically three periods. You had the Mao era, the Deng Zheng and Hu era, and now the President Xi era. And in the President Xi era, where we're talking about cooperation and harmony, And this seems to have mitigated a little bit, but not as much, depending on who you look at. But there seems to be a different strain going on in the background. I don't know whether this is a competing strain or this is getting a little bit of a visual of the Iron Fist underneath the velvet glove. But you had the, I guess it became really popular to say about 3 or 4 years ago, the Wolf Warrior Diplomacy after that silly movie they had. But it almost seems as if after this manifestation and perhaps overreach on their part, especially with the reaction Australia had to it and other nations, that's kind of gone back into the background. Is that part of a manifestation of what your response was to the previous question, or is this one of these competing schools inside the People's Republic of China as they try to position themselves in a larger role on the global stage?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that it's probably some of both, in that there seems to be some degree of disagreement within China about, you know, as China continues to grow and rise, like, how does China get the status and prestige and other sort of more material goods that it deserves as a great power, as a superpower, however you want to call it. So I think that there's still, and we tried to sort of at least hint at this a bit in the article, that there are the peaceful rise is part of the Chinese thinking. It seems to still be there, and it does seem to have a bit of a harder edge, and you know, that's definitely developed over the past few years. And the question is, is there sort of really clear competing ideas within the Chinese leadership about this, or is it more like, you know, the other phrasing is something like, you know, hide and bide your time kind of thing, or is it just like, oh, so how long do we sort of keep it soft until we get much harder, you know, so is it that there's agreement and that we're just hiding our, you know, biding our time until the right moment, and like, when is the right moment? There may be disagreement there. But there also may be real disagreement about, hey, what's actually the best approach? Is it kind of a softer line where we're trying to prove that it can provide good moral leadership for the world, and therefore through essentially soft power they will attract other countries to it and to its point of view and to its position. And so I think there's both plausible options there, and it's not really obvious to me. I think that there's what's going on within the CCP and within like the Politburo and so on and Standing Committee and all that, it seems to be a bit opaque, and I'm definitely not a China expert, number one, but as an observer and someone who consumes a lot of analysis about China, it seems to be quite opaque about how that's really run and what the different sort of trends are within China. I think one thing that interested me a lot was the end of the zero COVID policy. And there was a moment where it was that there was the growing protests. You didn't know, is this going to be like a replay of Tiananmen where there's a massive, like, harsh crackdown, or was the leadership going to kind of ease off? And they did ease off. And even though it seemed like Xi Jinping had really 100% put his name behind the zero COVID policy, is that this is a battle, you know, they were going to win, and Xi Jinping is going to win against COVID. There'll be no COVID cases, you know. And then almost with a snap of a finger, it's like, oh, no, never mind. You know, our policy has totally changed. And even now, as authoritarian countries like to do, they're sort of rewriting the past and saying, oh, no, we didn't really ever have a zero COVID policy. So there's something very interesting going on within the Chinese leadership where it doesn't seem to be exactly that Xi Jinping says, yes, this is what happens, this is what we're going to do, end of story. There seems to be some degree of, you know, pushback, probably isn't exactly the right word, but some debates that go on, and there is some changing of policies that do happen. And so I think that's interesting to watch in terms of how things do work domestically within China, and give us about, again, a pretty significant uncertainty about, well, like, has China even decided what it wants to do? You know, there's some authors who will say, well, China has a 100-year plan to conquer the world. And I just, And what I've observed about how governments work, they just don't work that way. China or anyone else, it is not possible. So I think that there's considerable uncertainty about what, you know, whether China even knows what it's really shooting for in all these areas. So I think that there's a lot going on there and a lot that we can't really observe very easily.
Yeah, I used to play around with decision tree analysis, and one of the, you know, when you're talking about uncertainties of outcome and what the probabilities are of certain things, the only things that seem to stand out with China is that they've been consistent about since 1949 of trying to bring Taiwan back as a state in the Chinese name. I mean, they don't recognize it as an independent nation, and that they want to get over now. I mean, the 100 years of humiliation from that date back to the Opium Wars. So, you know, and if you base that, then I think you all talked about the BRI, the program for the Belt Road Initiative, and their increasing number of nuclear weapons. Kind of talk about how those things kind of play together. If what I've asked makes any sense at all.
So I think that what we're trying to do with those are kind of our two case studies there about looking at here two, you know, big picture international initiatives that China's pushing and been pushing for a while now, and that they're investing a lot of resources in, right? And so a lot of people look at, let's take the Belt and Road Initiative, and it's sometimes portrayed as, wow, this is, you know, China going out economically, sort of like economic geopolitics. They're projecting power through economic might and so on. And they're going to be pulling all these countries into its orbit in Central Asia and the Middle East, even sort of flirting with some stuff in Europe, Southeast Asia, obviously. And so with all this, they're just going to really, you know, capture all these areas, you know, to some degree, right? And so part of what we're trying to say there, and this is actually since we first wrote there, you know, this is one of the things that Rennie works on a lot, and since this was written, is that it's even gotten more awkward, I guess, for China, I would say, in that there was stories coming out, I think it was last week, where all these countries are going to have to be foreclosed upon. All these projects don't make money. They're not effective. They're breaking down. And there are supposed to be these big infrastructure projects that would tie these countries to China, but it's simply not working very well. And people who are, you know, on the sort of more like libertarian side of things, it would be like, of course, you know, huge massive government projects, there are often big flaws with them, right? And so when you also look at countries like China and the, you know, the countries they're dealing with here that are highly corrupt, you know, money that should go to making these projects be super effective and wonderful for everybody, they're being siphoned off by all sides, right? So it's simply not working out. They don't have the capabilities to make these huge initiatives work out very well. And people are of course noticing this now, and other countries are seeing that, well, China is not the savior, you know, that it's not going to help our countries develop, you know, it's just not working, right? So China making big efforts to kind of, you know, throw its weight around and get more influence seems to be not working out exactly how China wanted it to. On the area of nuclear weapons, which, you know, Rennie's through his geospatial intelligence work, he's, you know, he's seen a lot of satellite pictures of the stuff that China's been doing with the nuclear weapons program, and they're doing a lot. They are doing a lot to modernize their program, but the question then is, for a long time, their guiding policy was minimal deterrence, essentially the idea that, well, if we have, you know, a couple hundred nukes, and that's good enough because we can probably get one through. If we can get one through to hit a major city, that's enough deterrence for us. We're not going to worry that much about it beyond that. But that's not generally the approach a superpower would take. So we had the U.S. and the Soviet Union in their long-term competition during the Cold War. A lot of that, you know, was express through competition over creating better and more and bigger nuclear weapons. So China, unsurprisingly, probably is following a similar line there, where they want to maybe get closer to parity with the U.S. But then again, is that a threat whereby China wants to use a stronger nuclear shield to be able to then do more stuff conventionally? And again, maybe it feels like if it has a stronger nuclear deterrent, then it can do something more against Taiwan or other places and shield itself in that way. These nuclear threats, sort of coercive power, you know? Or is it simply that China is tired of being so weak compared to the U.S. in its terms of its nuclear weapons program? So even if you see a significant modernization increase in nuclear weapons with China, you still don't really have much to say about their goals. We don't know what their goals are, what their intent is with that. And that a lot of times I always look at, I like to think about, well, what if, you know, the U.S. was in China's position, vice versa? You know, would we want to sit here and have a nuclear weapons program, you know, whatever, a quarter of the size of China's? Would we be happy with that? We probably wouldn't. So China probably isn't going to be happy with that either. Now, what exactly they intend to do with a more powerful nuclear weapon, you know, program, that we don't know.
I had to kind of grin when you were talking about how things with the Belt and Road Initiative are, quote, not working out. I think probably an area of agreement, U.S. and Chinese counterparts and the planning parts in their State Departments is talking about the lessons you learn from trying to project your cultures onto others. Just like we couldn't quite make Afghans, Iraqis, and Nicaraguans into Americans. It looks like they're having a little bit of trouble getting Cambodians, Sri Lankans, and Zimbabweans to align with Taoism and Confucius views of the world. But the, I guess, all expanding powers have to learn that lesson one way or another. In the article, you outline some challenges. In addition to the unknown challenges, you had warfighting challenge, influence challenge, and economics challenge. And I was curious, as far as the PRC's ability that they're growing, how would you rank those against each other? And on the other side of the coin, where do you think the U.S. and her friends and allies are best positioned to counter?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I think that, to me, I like to put this up on Twitter pretty frequently, is that the China seems to be pretty bad at soft power. And so on the influence side, you know, even when they're trying to really do a materially based, you know, economic sort of policy where they're essentially paying off various countries, the BRI and stuff like that, they're not very successful with that. And then other areas of influence, they seem to be just constantly putting their foot in their mouth, shooting themselves in their foot, whatever foot metaphor you like, you can use any of those. They just don't seem to be really good at influencing other countries. And so part of this is sort of like the wolf warrior diplomacy part that's sort of taken hold and where they're just acting pretty hostile. And so I think that's an area where, to me, the U.S. has a pretty significant advantage. And that it's pretty sad the U.S. isn't really doing more in that area. And I think that's a place where this becomes if the U.S. and China conflict, you know, it really becomes an influence challenge, a soft power challenge, then I'm super happy with that because I think the U.S. has a huge advantage there. Now, if you move over to the military or economic arenas, there are some, I think, more significant challenges there. On that, I think that the U.S. has to work harder in constructing trade agreements with countries in East Asia, South Asia, and work harder on that. I think I was not that happy when the U.S. did not go forward with the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, whatever the right acronym there is. And that's also become something new now, so the U.S. then would have to do a different process to sign on to that. So I think something along those lines, it would be good for the U.S. But that's, in the economic competition, I think the U.S. has to, you know, work in that area of how do we make sure that even as these countries are trading a lot with China, that they're still a major U.S. trading partner as well, and that we're facilitating as much as we can. I think that's extremely important. I think on the military side, in some ways that's the biggest challenge. In some ways it's sort of not. I guess in the way that it seems to me to be a very significant challenge is if the U.S. is trying to project military power, you know, within whatever 100 miles, 50 miles of the Chinese coastline, that's a pretty big challenge. And so that's probably the hardest challenge that it seems to me of what's going on here. I think in terms of global projection of power, China can in no way match what the U.S. has, not even close. The amount of bases the U.S. has worldwide, the amount of the ability, the logistical ability of the U.S. to project power abroad, like no one can match the U.S. in that. So if it becomes also a competition there where China's trying to go out and sort of actually physically sort of conquer the world in terms of, you know, creating all these basing initiatives that to match the U.S. and so on, I think that's a failing strategy for China. So I guess the toughest thing would be if the U.S. is somehow drawn into a military conflict with China, very close to China, that seems to be the toughest problem and ideally something that we can avoid.
Well, I thought it was interesting that if we can't predict, I think you said, instead of trying to predict China's intentions, goals, and strategies, then we should focus on other things like shaping conditions that affect China's intentions, goals, and strategies. When you're doing a commander's intent, one of the things you look at are the capabilities, at least what you believe the capabilities of it. I think you talked about this earlier. You know, you assess the capabilities of the other guy, and you try to figure out what they can do with those. So, you know, you develop a decision tree kind of thing. I think part of what I got out of this was that the suggestion is we don't have to worry about that. We need to what's the word from, Candide. We have to tend to our own garden. That garden includes, as you said, making good alliances, and kind of go along with that thought. What should we be doing in light of the fact that we have a known unknown and we don't really know where the Chinese strategies are going?
Yeah, so I would say there's two big things. And it's that one thing is what we call, you know, sort of self-strengthening kind of things, building up our own capabilities, capacities, and so on. And that there are, I think if we sat here for 10 minutes, we'd come up with 100 things that the United States could do to put itself on a stronger footing, you know, moving forward. A lot of it could be, you know, very internally oriented. Some of it could be externally oriented. But things that the U.S. can do to put its own house in order, to make it stronger moving forward. A whole long list of things we could do. Some things we would probably disagree on, but there'd be a lot of things, proposals that we could put out there, right? And so there's that kind of set of things that I think are important to look at. And then there's also, in terms of shaping, I think that, like I said, so there's been this wisdom going back for centuries, from Sun Tzu to Clausewitz to even more recently Wiley, J.C. Wiley, is that one thing that you'd like to do in terms of a strategy is sort of, you know, I think Wiley called it shaping the pattern of war. Clausewitz said, you know, understanding what kind of conflict you're in. And even if we take a step back and broaden that, it's like, so what and how and where is the competition going to occur with China? You know, I think competition is an okay word because it seems like we are in that, right? So, but then what form is it going to take, you know? And so for the U.S., if we can sort of shape that competition in certain ways and push it towards a certain direction that's better for us, more advantageous for us, that's a good thing. So I think that, you know, trying to get China to compete with us over influence about, hey, maybe we should go to ASEAN, the regional sort of organization in Southeast Asia, and say, hey, we're going to really invest a lot in our diplomacy here. We're going to make sure we go to all the meetings. We're going to try and set the agenda. We're going to really try and push this and kind of see how China responds. And China can either, oh, we don't care about ASEAN. Nobody cares about that. It's a weak organization. Nobody really cares. They can take that, and so they cede that terrain to the U.S., and then the U.S. can use that to its advantage, or China can be like, oh, wait, we need to get in on this game. And so then competition starts to play out in terms of that arena, which, like I said, I think the U.S. has an advantage there. So I think that's, in terms of sort of shaping the type of conflict that happens, I think it's much better for the U.S. to be having that kind of competition rather than most other kinds of competition, right? So I think there's that that goes on. I think the alliance piece kind of helps with both a bit. And so, of course, you know, one of the main purposes of an alliance is that you aggregate your power. And there are some great allies in East Asia for the United States that can add a lot to our capabilities there across a full range of areas, you know. So, of course, Japan, I think in the article we focus a lot on Japan and South Korea. And when we were writing it, it was sort of like a dream of like, oh, hey, it would be great if this could be more of a trilateral alliance instead of more of like a hub and spokes thing, a trilateral where the U.S. and the Republic of Korea and Japan, that they're coming together and they're cooperating on more and more things. That would be, I think, much better for the U.S. in terms of having a tighter alliance instead of being like, oh, the U.S. is going to talk to Japan. The U.S. is then going to talk to South Korea, go back, talk to Japan. That seems less effective, right? So moving it more towards trilateral and then also pulling in other countries as it seems that that's appropriate. So the Philippines would probably be the next on the list to be like, hey, this is another really important country in the situation. You can simply look at a map and see what are the most important countries there. And you look at, okay, Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, Vietnam. These are very important countries when you look at, you know, U.S. interests in East and Southeast Asia, you know. So, and so I think that in my tracking of the news, the U.S. has been moving in this direction, and there is some kind of rapprochement going on between South Korea and Japan. They seem to be cooperating together more on things. They're seem to be working more with the U.S. in terms of a trilateral kind of situation, which that's another thing I like to highlight on or underline a lot on Twitter a lot is to point out when these things are happening and really emphasize these are important and really useful for the U.S. And so I think in terms of, you know, how alliances, of course, they bring power, so that's a self-strengthening thing. It brings power to the U.S. side and influence, and it also helps sort of shape the environment so that China all of a sudden, if China looks, you know, off its coastline and says, oh, you know, these alliances the U.S. have, they're pretty weak, and they're divided, they're factionalized, these countries are fighting amongst each other. U.S. and Japan might have a strong alliance, but the other countries, everything else is kind of weak. We can take advantage of this. We can kind of divide and conquer and stuff. Or China can look out and say, oh, wow, there's really tightened alliances here. There's no room for us to push on that at all. We need to change the way we look at this and rethink how we're going about this because, you know, this isn't a good situation for us. And, you know, we can't really divide and conquer. We have to rethink this, you know. So I think there's, regardless of whether even China does want to, would even think about trying to divide and conquer or not, if it's not feasible, they just aren't going to go that direction at all. So in this way, you can try and shape conditions, you know, affect conditions within shape what Chinese intentions will be in the future. I think that's ideally a direction that the U.S. could go.
Yeah, I really liked how you and your co-authors brought in the concept of shaping as a way to tie in a few things together. You know, we have our bilats with the Japanese and the Australians, but we also have AUKUS that's bringing in the Brits more. But, of course, we also have one-on-ones with the Brits. And, of course, the Australians and the Brits have their own relationships. You also briefly mentioned the Quad. And it tied into another concept that you brought in later on. You know, what are the frustrating things? Well, let me reprioritize here. One of the great things about the U.S. and most of our allies is where we're wonderfully fractious democratic systems that change governments and have competing centers of power at the end, in theory, trying to produce a better quality of life for their citizens. The downside of our system of governance compared to the PRCs is we are a fractious, ever-changing political system that is hard to get some continuity. So people have been looking for that unicorn called the bipartisan consensus, that depending upon which party is in power, if you're willing to accept the 80% agreement is continuity and the 20% is just creative friction, if you can get 80%, you have that bipartisan consensus. And towards the end, y'all brought out something, repurposing a word that goes back to George Washington, that there's this binary, and I believe we're in agreement here, I think it's a false argument that you have China doves, pick your stereotype from the 1990s through the mid-2010s. Some people use the A word, appeasement. They were really trying to just engage with China, engagement, versus the other false binary, I believe, which are the China hawks, which is everybody needs to get ready to go to war in fiscal year 2027 because that's what the entrails of the sheep tell us is going to take place. That in between there, it kind of brings in the Quad, AUKUS, and other arrangements with the Philippines you were talking about a moment ago, is entanglement, which in the American instinct has the spines go out and the claws come out defensively because it's a negative connotation. But you try to describe how in your co-author's view that a constructive entanglement is actually a positive. Outline the positive type of entanglement that y'all were describing towards the end of the article.
Yes, I wanted to use the word entanglement, which historically in the U.S. it was thought of with the negative sensibilities. Is sort of, you go back to the 19th century, even early 20th century, first half of the 20th century maybe, that the U.S. should not be entangled with the rest of the world. We should avoid these entanglements. And that the U.S. actually is corrupted by being too much engaged with the concerns of the rest of the world. The U.S. is exceptional, it's different, it should maintain that space. That's sort of like one of the guiding ideas in American diplomacy, early diplomacy. So I kind of wanted to reclaim that a bit and also sort of place our flag in the sand and say, we're not just talking about, being a little bit more. And I wanted to really signify like, no, this means doing a lot more in terms of, again, creating that alliance system in East Asia, Southeast Asia, Western Pacific, whatever you want to call the region. And so I didn't want to say, oh, we just need to do a little bit more fine-tuning alliances. No, I think we need to really invest a lot in that. And that means, a lot of time amongst the principles of being there and really striving for a really strong alliance there. Again, starting with the Japan and South Korea and then expanding that out and in tying that in also with these other partnerships that are there, AUKUS and the Quad and so on. And also wanted to draw attention to, I think there's almost sort of an American fetish with Australia that, I don't want to put this in too harsh a line, but it's that somehow that Australia is the strong position in the Western Pacific, and this is the position of strength to then, go against China or something like that. We should look at maps more. And you look at a map, and Australia is pretty far from China. There's a lot of countries in between Australia and China. And while, yes, I very much appreciate Australia and their strong alliance with the U.S., it's rock solid and it's great. They provide a lot of capacities and capabilities for the U.S. and the partnership and so on. But to me, the number one thing, the point of action in this is Japan and South Korea and the Philippines, that area. That's what I really want to focus on and say, hey, we need to entangle ourselves in that region with those allies and really make that work. And that's, and what we try and say is that, you know, no matter what happens, no matter what kind of challenge we see emerging in the next, you know, 5, 10, 20, 30, even more years, that that's a no regrets move right there. Having that strong alliance is going to help no matter what happens. I mean, I can't say no matter what, but anything I can imagine, having that really strong alliance there is going to help. Again, on the economic side, if we really strengthen those relationships, that means they're not going to be continually pulled into the Chinese economic orbit. That means on the influence side, they're going to stick with the U.S. On the military side, they have huge capabilities there that they can contribute to any kind of conflict that could happen in East Asia. Also, I was going to try and look this up before I got on here, but there's this article in the journal Orbis written, I think it was around 2011, 2012, where it paints this, or it describes this hypothetical situation where the U.S. uses a carrier in East Asia. And it's done by China, but it's done in a way such that it blurs the situation so much that it's not really clear what exactly happened. And because U.S. influence in East Asia had fallen so much, even its allies were sort of like, well, yeah, we don't know what really happened. We're not going to do anything about this, you know. And so I think that I actually think about that a lot. It's a good article, and it draws to mind that also if you're thinking about Ukraine, is that the importance of having allies on your side that are strong, that can contribute, and will trust you, I think, is really priceless. So I think going all in on that, or not necessarily all in, but going strongly in on that, I think helps no matter what the situation is. And I think, like you said, wherever you fall on that spectrum of wanting to do more engagement or more containment or wherever, I mean, you need that. You definitely need that. So I think it is something that I think generally a lot of people can agree upon is investing in that.
Yeah, what I liked about that approach was that you suggested that if we did this right, we would not be, again, it's not directed toward, we need you to help us fight China. It is more, we are your allies, we will work together with you in any number of ways to meet a lot of different situations. As I think you said, entanglement is quite distinct from engagement. While the latter was meant to foster liberalization with China, entanglement takes active steps to strengthen alliances and rules-based order in East and Southeast Asia. It is largely independent of the internal characteristics of Chinese politics and society, can respond to either a more aggressive or less aggressive Chinese foreign policy. Can you kind of talk about that a little more? Is that, because I think that's kind of a key section of what you mean by this entanglement rather than pure alliance, anti-China stuff.
Yeah, because it is, there's ideas out there that are suggesting that, well, the way that we should approach this is just approach every other country out there and say, hey, we want you on board to fight China. We want you on board of this anti-China agenda. Other countries are uncomfortable with that. They don't want to make that choice when it's put to them like that. It's like it's us or them. They don't really want to make that choice, you know. And so it's alienating to try and force that decision on all variety of countries from South Korea through South Asia to Africa. They don't want that. They also don't find that authentic. It's, you know, we're not going over to Nigeria and saying, hey, Nigeria, you're a great country. You're a strong country. You're growing. We really think that we can do great things together. If you say it in that way, that's one way of doing it. In other ways, like, hey, Nigeria, you see the these agreements with China. We don't like that. You have to choose us instead. That's not, it's not the same way. It's not the same energy, the same vibe, you know. And so I think that by approaching these countries and saying, hey, we want to create these close relationships with you, and we think that there are mutual interests that we can work on here, I think that's a much better way of approaching it. And I think that the side benefit will be that, again, as we can even see this in the evolution of how South Korea is sort of looking at China and the U.S. and so on, is that they're noticing that China is not behaving well from a South Korean perspective. You know, and so as if we come in and say, hey, no, we're not trying to force you into an anti-Chinese perspective. We're just trying to get closer with you. And then China steps on its own feet again and does all that stuff. And then those other countries are like, yeah, actually China is not doing things that we like. We're glad they work close to the United States, and this is actually driving us even closer to you. And we like that you didn't force us to make a choice. You know, you gave us that option. You reached out your hand of friendship. We took it, and now we're glad to have you as friends because we're now getting very worried about China. I think that's sort of what we're seeing in a series of countries here, and I think that's advantageous for the United States for sure.
Of course, we haven't touched on it yet today, but the 800-pound gorilla in the national security arena over the last year has been the Russo-Ukrainian war. And from both an economic, diplomatic, and a military perspective, everybody is looking at that to, as you do with all really medium-sized wars, trying to learn some lessons to see how what theories play out, what confirms your priors, what challenges your priors. From your perspective, looking for Beijing as much as we can, having looked at their priorities and their views, what do you think are some of the takeaways the PRC is looking at closely from the Russo-Ukrainian war to this point?
That's a good question. I think that a lot of people are trying to sort of figure that out, and there's sort of a debate going on that, well, on the one hand, maybe China is saying, wow, military operations seem pretty hard, and countries that even have a significant, quantitative advantage, they might have a lot of trouble in carrying out, complex operations. So I think that's possibly one way of thinking about it. And I think, in addition to that is that I think that the tightening or close nature of the Western alliance, I think, is something that's also probably getting some people's attention. And I think on both those elements, this probably makes China a little more wary about trying to be aggressive in any sort of military fashion, is the troubles that Russia has had, and then the ability of U.S. and its allies to respond pretty quickly and strongly to it. So I think on those ends, that probably gives China pause in certain ways. I think on the other side of the equation, though, there's a number of countries that have not necessarily sided, obviously, quickly with the United States that you think they might do a little more strongly, whether it's like Brazil or South Africa or other countries like that, or even in India to some extent. They're not really jumping in like maybe the U.S. would want them to do. Jumping in metaphorically of supporting the U.S. and supporting Ukraine and so on. So I think, China probably sees some space there and kind of is maybe interested in that. Otherwise, I think they're probably, very interested in the performance of like certain weapon systems and things of that nature and different, overarching, I don't necessarily want to say military strategies, but maybe operational art and maybe the strategies behind it. They're probably interested in how that's playing out in terms of also with regard to what weapon system are being involved and are being useful or not. So I think those are some of the issues, but I think probably the net effect is pretty positive on the U.S. and U.S. allies kind of side. At least that's how I'm sort of interpreting at this point.
Well, that's a good point to put a stop to the show, although I think we could talk for quite a while more. Before we let you go, and let me thank you for coming on with us, Jeffrey, and let me ask you this. What are you working on that our listeners be interested in, and where can people find out more about your writings and other thoughts?
Yeah, so I'm pretty active on Twitter, and I'm happy to engage with people there. I'm happy to get messages, or you can also just Google me and find me on University of Portland website, and you can email me there. Happy to get emails and correspond with people. Right now, my big project for the summer is trying to finish up this manuscript on a book on strategy. So I've been trying to work a lot on strategy for the past couple of years, and so trying to finally get that wrapped up and hopefully get that out in publication in the next year or so would be great.
Well, Jeffrey, it's been great having you on here, and I do encourage all the listeners to make sure and give Jeffrey a listen to when you get a chance and to track what you're doing. And look forward to the next opportunity, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was great fun.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. And until next time, hope you all have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Friend and Piccadilly, or you'll